Hello and welcome to recording number 11 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 11th, 2021. We're going to be starting chapter 8. In the previous chapter, Gord has finally broken free from his captors, regained most of his lost goods and his horse, and gotten his revenge upon Yahud and about a quarter of the Rodan nomads who had captured him. Now he's leaving the scene of the battle between the Rodan and the Yolai, and he has discovered that there is a woman asking for help who is pinned beneath her horse. And so I'm going to start right here on page 129, chapter 8, two of the first paragraph. Long, long ago, two great empires fought a war of mutual annihilation. One empire, the Baklunish, was fractured and made backwards, and the land of this race was turned arid and poor. To this day, the Bakluni are not a nation anymore, but a collection of tribes that contest with each other for the dubious privilege of controlling the harsh, featureless lands of the western part of the Flaness. Break. Well, that's, pretty much true. I mean, the greater amount of what was once, the Baklunish Empire is no more. And the wastelands, they do cover much of Zyph. They cover the dry steppes here, plains of the Paynims. And only really the most outer of the member states have survived. Now, Zyph was a very big kingdom. And in my own campaign, it's the oldest kingdom and a little bit of a fantasy Egypt. It's not that way in everybody's campaigns, the way I like to run it. Now, Ket has survived, but it's still a border state. And the people of Ket are still considered the Bakluni. Ul has survived, but much diminished. And they, too, are considered Bakluni by the nomads, who are surprisingly don't consider themselves to be Baklunish anymore. Then you get up to Tuzmit, and they're a semi-nomadic people, according to Gygax. And we have Ekber, which is probably one of the few nations that survived and grew after the invoked devastation that destroyed the Baklunish Empire. Now, I model the various Bakluni states in different ways. The Tiger Nomads are very Mongolian to me. The Ekber are modeled after the Persian Empire. And if you go on Cannon Fire, I used the history of the Persian kings and caliphs as the history for Ekbar, with some changes in it. Ekbar was also a naval port before the invoked devastation. And so today it's actually a bigger state than it was at the time. And it's only like the far ends now. We have the plains of the Paynims, where they're destroyed, the dry steppes are destroyed. The Tuzmiti are kind of thrown into turmoil. The people of Ul are driven backwards, I'd think. So you have very few. It's a very smashed up, a much less powerful group of people. And they're fractured so that they're at war with themselves. So they don't consider themselves Bakluni. That the bulk of them are these nomads. And so you can see here, the Paynim are at war with this Aradan. The Aradan fight the Uls. probably fight the Tazmidi. The Tazmidi fight the Paynims. They fight the Kedesh. They fight the Zaif, people of Zaif. They probably have conflict with the Tiger nomads in the north and the Ekbar, the people of Ekbar in the very north along the coast. But I'd say that probably what has survived of the old Baklunish Empire's fragment is in Ekbar, and that I feel definitely has a Persian Empire flavor. All right. So in right here, they are correct. You know, it is, but the lands, though harsh, they aren't exactly completely featureless. They're not as bad as things that happened to the Sul and the Reign of Colorless Fire, which has really devastated the old Sul Imperium. All right. The people of the Second Empire, however, suffered even more when the Bakluni retaliatory strike came. Their fair land was scathed by a magically created storm of fire, colorless flames that consumed all life. When all was done, virtually all of the once mighty Second Empire, known as the Sulis, was covered in a layer of dust and fine ashes. Gray and lifeless, wind-driven and parched, this covering of ruin blanketed the land for 1,000 and more miles in every direction from its center. Indeed, it stretched like water across the landscape, and the area became known around the continent of Urk as the Ashen Desert. When the invisible firestorm finally ended, all who viewed this seemingly endless vista of dust and ash, a gray-black desert born of destruction, assumed that nothing could live in such a place. Of course, they were quite mistaken. All right, break. So we see here, really, the Sul, according to this, now, everything, yeah, I haven't said this in a while, but you have to remember that there is no omnipotent viewpoint with Gygax. Everything is being spoken as unreliable sources. So no matter what they say, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because what they say may not be true. It may be from a certain viewpoint only. So we hear about this Sul, and they're said here to have started everything. They're saying that the invoked devastation came first, but before the end, the Bakluni were able to cause the Reign of Colorless Fire. All right, so we then have that, you know, this devastation is in like a 1,000-mile radius around the center of the Sul Imperium here. And so all these areas within the protective wall, mountain ranges are destroyed and burnt. And so it is this burnt ash that has coated everything like an ocean. And eaten up all of like the top layers of the soil and the unprotected, what was unprotected. Now, how far this stuff burnt down, there's still ruins left, according to Gygax. Now, some of them come from areas that were protected from the actual fire. The main city called the City Out of Mind to the Baklunish, and the Forgotten City among the people of the East, of the Flaness, that was protected for years and years from, and it survived the destruction of the fire, so it never burnt. And several of the outposts also never burnt, because at the time there were many powerful individuals in the Sul Imperium with more access to greater magic than has been seen since. And they were able to keep their outposts and towns and stuff from burning. But the rest of the Imperium, everything of the original Imperium is gone. So all the small manor houses burnt. But whether if they were made of things like stone or tougher than stone, then they probably survived but were buried in the ash. And then, you know, it became a question of all the arable land's been destroyed, all the cattle's been destroyed, unless it was protected. And so the people there needed to flee or starve for the most part. And then we get the migrations, the great fleeing of the survivors from the Sul Imperium. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 129 and the final paragraph. The daemon crafters of the decimated Sulis Empire were so accomplished in the magical arts that they were able to shield their capital city from the fiery storm before it fell. For a time at least, life continued in this metropolis, buried beneath 100 and more feet of dust. A few of the other major cities of Sul managed to prevent the ravages of the colorless fire from fully affecting them, and there were isolated strongholds of powerful magic and magi and priests that preserved despite the devastation. The ash and dust covered so much of the landscape, though, that the blanketing might as well have been complete. To make matters worse, volcanoes born out of the upheaval erupted, adding even more flakes and grains to that which was already there, and the great storms drove and shaped the whole mass. One after another, the Sulis outposts of survival were smothered and buried, as years became decades, and decades centuries. But life is persistent, especially on those worlds where the mutable laws of magic take precedence over the immutable laws of science. As humans died, other forms of life discovered the Ashen Desert and found it desirable. At the same time, certain living things that had somehow managed to survive the destruction that had fallen upon their land adapted and mutated to survive in the new environment. Monstrous single-celled amoeboid creatures flowed under the dust and ashes, feeding on the residue of the fire and leaving traces of matter and moisture for other tiny organisms to thrive upon. Giant multi-celled clusters, colony animals fed on silicates and carboniferous materials, returning the favor by depositing as waste other sorts of minerals that smaller life forms found beneficial. All right, break. So this section right here is, you know, we're describing, Gygax is describing post Reign of Colorless Fire. And as I had mentioned, yes, several areas the magi and the priests preserved, not only the central city, but also these outposts. And you will see, like on some of the maps, the unnamed ruins on the edges of the Sea of Dust. Now, here it's also talking about how creatures that preferred this kind of life, they flowed into the Sea of Dust. And also these other creatures started to mutate and develop. Now, Gygax's single-celled mutations, monstrous amoeboid creatures, obviously he's heavily influenced by At the Mountains of Madness by H.P. Lovecraft. And so I think we can expect to see I prefer a little Lovecraftian tinge to my Greyhawk. And one of the places I think is the Sea of Dust should have that horrific flavor to it. There is also a Clark Ashton Smith story. What is it? It's a very famous one, and I've even written a little pastiche that is like a homage to it. And I'd say it is definitely, this is definitely an influence upon Gygax, is both Lovecraft and Clark Ashton Smith. And so I the Sea of Dust should be presented, no matter how you really look at it. I think you can really enhance your campaign by looking at it as something very alien, stark, and horrific, rather than any kind of normal desert or landscape that you find within the earth. What is born out of all this, the magic that was used to protect the cities and the outposts, the magic coming from the rain of colorless fire, that has not produced just a land that's been burnt, like, say, by a massive firestorm, or even the additions of the volcanoes rising up. Now, that what it has produced is a horrific land of nightmare. There is also work by, what is his name, William Hope Hodgson, I think, called The Nightland. And I believe you can find a lot of inspiration between some of the Clark Ashton Smith stories. I believe it's like The Desert of Yolando, and also Lovecraft's At the Mountain of Madness. And here, either there's several very horrific William Hope Hodgson stories, and I believe it is The Nightlands that would do best for inspiring things in the Sea of Dust. But whatever you do, and whatever tact you take, I think it's a real real enhancement, campaign enhancement, to take the Sea of Dust out of the normal and make it into the horrific. All right, so there is mention of volcanoes rising up. Now, if you look at Anna's map, not Anna's map, I'm sorry, even the Darlene map of the Sea of Dust, you're really not seeing the volcanoes within that circle. And I had thought that at some point there was mention that that strange circling of the mountains around the Sul Imperium was not the way it was at the time of the Imperium, that there were actually gaps in the mountain ranges. And I kind of take it that these volcanoes are what rose, brought these mountains up and actually surrounded, you know, maybe the outer effects of the spell are what created some of this circular mountain range that we have now that is, you know, incredibly unnatural. So I believe the Sul Imperium had access in the southeast, where, you know, the Sea Kings are now. I know that several, in the Living Greyhawk Gazetteer, I've just passed, there is a lost town from the age of the Imperium that is mentioned in the Living Greyhawk Gazetteer. That is a town that was outside of the Sea of Dust, in that area of the Sea Kings. I believe it was supposed to be a mining town. Has been lost since the time of the Imperium. And it may be an area that another town has risen up upon. But that town, you know, at this point does not exist in modern Earth, modern Flaness. And it is a town from the time of the Imperium outside of this circle of mountain ranges. And I add the idea of volcanoes rising to the, you know, my own belief that the circular mountain ranges only exist completely exist like that only after the colorless fire was cast upon the Sul Imperium. All right, I'm going to continue. It's page 130 in the final paragraph. After these lower creatures prepared the way, monstrous things grew up in the domain that the amoeboids and colony growths had dominated. Various types of slugs, all of them small at first, found that they had no enemies beneath the layers and layers of dust and ash, and they thrived on the growth that had sprung up there. These slugs got much larger, but the biggest of them was still no larger than an average man. Then they burrowed even farther down and found the springs and bubbling wells that still flowed deep, deep under the dust, but feeding in such places, engorging themselves with water, the slugs became more and more gigantic, and they made still other life possible. Because of their size, and as was their nature, the slugs move with the aid of trails of mucus, which they secreted from all around the exterior of their bodies. This slime, once exuded, hardened quickly. The less massive slugs left small tunnels through the ash and dust, and the big ones left comparably large passages. A network of twisting, turning, pipe-like burrows grew beneath the ashen desert. These passages generally led from one water source to another. Eventually, old tunnels collapsed. Some were destroyed by the passage of larger slugs. Others, by the still surviving amoebopods and colony monsters, puddings, as their relatives elsewhere were referred to, and many fell due to pressure caused by the growth of vegetation beneath and through the dust. While all this was going on, new passages were being made continually anyway, so the change was hardly noticed, and certainly was not perceived as such by the non-intelligent creatures that spent all their lives in this strange and forbidding domain. Break. So, it's also, noted that the main city buried 100 feet under dust. So, the whole land is not only burnt, but the ash rises after the fire. The volcanoes erupt, and they're spreading even more ash. So the whole of the Imperium and the ruins and such are buried. And unless the survivors dig them out, they're going to be buried not as tremendously deep as 100 feet. The ash is not going to keep the rains from coming. It's not going to stop it from being compacted. But it is going to be then a harder substance, a sealed layer over everything that's fallen. And unless the people below tunnel up, they are going to be buried. And so as the ash turns, and these creatures develop, and as people tunnel out, there is an easy passage is carved through the ash. And beneath them, there is still the under-earth to dig into. So that even though the level of the ground among the whole Sul Imperium has risen, because the ash has coated things, and it's buried beneath like a sea, it does get further compacted. And then we see a good example of Chris has just posted of the giant slug. And that could be taken very well as a scene from one of the ruined cities of the underearth, beneath the top of the sea of dust. So we can see that there were going to be huge passages created by these monstrous slugs. Yeah, this is out of the first monster manual. And I wonder if it was also part of an inspiration for things that Gygax was talking about. But like I said, there are several things that are very much like this, very inspiring. A lot of the early writers wrote in this way. I'm trying to think of several other... there are several other stories that are quite like this, from Burroughs, from A. Merritt, in his books, The Face in the Abyss, Dwellers in the Mirage, The Moon Pool, all by A. Merritt would be good inspiration. Maybe even The People of the Pit, which is a famous Merritt short story. Chris says he doesn't see the reference to colony monsters, but Gygax does jump over here. So puddings are colony monsters. I would say gelatinous cubes, all of the various puddings. But yes, now Gygax was heavily influenced by Lieber, who wrote the Fairford and Mauser stories. So with, like, the City of Greyhawk, we get quite a bit of Lankmar, the stories, the city from Lieber. But when we are out here in this area here, and I think like the Land of Black Ice, but especially here in the Sea of Dust, I think this... There's an article in Dragon early on about the Cthulhu mythos, but they also, in the early deities and demigods in first edition, without permission, they published some of the Cthulhu monsters. But honestly, you can simply grab the lore from... Now, Call of Cthulhu has some wonderful source books, but... You can look at the Lovecraft, you can look at Call of Cthulhu, and instead of grabbing the mechanics, you can grab the descriptions. And just one of the things about the mythos is that they have so powerful. And then there is a Clark Ashton Smith story about the Abominations of Yondu. Yes, that is one of the short stories. And then... there's another one about the tales of it's these tales of this adventurer who's gone to this abandoned city and run into Sagagath, who is this kind of Lovecraftian god that Clark Ashton Smith wrote, and that again gives you some ideas of what's going on there, you know, and things that you can use. And Gygax himself takes this, and he really is inspired by it. And in this section we're reading right here is some amazing material. And yeah, I do like, especially they got Errol Otis, who's fantastic at this kind of thing, to do the Cthulhu mythos illustrations, and there's some bubbling creatures there that are just actually, you know, they're fantastic. There's some comment that Smith is a better overall writer than Lovecraft. And Smith was a very, you know, again, though, both Smith and Lovecraft were self-educated. They learned their skills from reading in libraries and reading old books. You know, that is this line of inspiration that's going through here. Smith was a absolutely fantastic writer. Lovecraft is imagination, and his ability to evoke was incredible too. And it's something that if you're going to do things, a lot of times you have to realize that less is sometimes much better. You know, there's things that really scare you, and most of the times they are not gore. Like if you go to a movie and you see things that are very gory, it eventually just makes you used to it, and it no longer scares you. But what Lovecraft and also Smith and also A. Merritt were very good at, were they were good at evoking your own imagination. And I mention this especially because that is a lesson that Gygax took to heart. In these books, and in the original campaign, less is more. If you start out with them, all your pictures in your mind of, they're going to be your imagination. And even if you move on later, you're going to be able to look at something written by someone else, Sargent or Reynolds or Roger Moore or... whoever, and you're going to be able to say, this is good, I like this, this doesn't fit with what I'm thinking. Because if you first go to somebody like Sargent, you're going to think Sargent. And if you first go to the more bare-bones material of the folio and box set, and even what Gygax is writing here, you're going to create the pictures. Now, maybe your mind, Chris has put up one of Errol Otis's... two of Errol Otis's Cthulhu mythos, and my, what imagination, what a mind. I don't know if you even really want to be thinking like this, but he is very evocative. But still, the first thing you should always do is read the text and then see the pictures. Let your mind be the picture. And so as we go through the Sea of Death right here, we're going to be hearing all these descriptions. And you let your mind take these evocations from Gygax, these just word descriptions, and they will build a picture in your mind, and later on things will look the way you want them to look. Even if you can't really, you don't realize, later on you'll be able to pull out things from your own even hidden imagination, and you'll be able to see if you like what somebody else is expressing or don't like. But if you see the picture first, lots of times it overwhelms, then that is the picture. That is the picture that jumps into your mind, and it's very hard. And you'll never really get beyond, you'll never completely be beyond what the picture evokes over what your imagination evokes if you see the picture first. All right. I'm going to continue on. It is page 131, and it is the final paragraph. Plants are hardy, and some survive the destruction to grow anew. Seeds sent roots deep beneath the surface, seeking the moisture that still lay there, and thrust stems and tendrils up through ash and dust, seeking sunlight. Where tens or hundreds of feet of the stuff covered it, the vegetation failed, but in a few places only a relatively thin layer of dust lay between the plants and the light above. Still, most of the growths that made the journey upwards successfully didn't survive. The searing heat and the tearing wind that buffeted the plants with fine, abrasive particles saw to that. Many sorts of vegetation that managed to survive the elements fell prey to insects and hardy mammals still dwelling on the surface, who fed on their leaves, seeds, and stems, as all forms of life will do. The plants adapted in their changing, they grew defenses of many sorts. Eventually, over the centuries, a dozen species with a dozen varieties each managed or survived, if not always flourish, in the sea-like desert of ash and powdered dirt. Insects burrowed beneath this stuff. Some few of them lived in a symbiotic relationship with plants, and others survived by eating the vegetation. A few birds, too, dwelled among the plants or adapted to making their homes in burrows below the dusty surface. Some fed on vegetation, others on insects, and not all insects ate vegetation. Some sought other insects, avians, or even small mammals to feed upon. A complex ecosystem developed. Cacti of new sorts grew. Wire-like trees stretched up, showing only their branch tips unless a storm shifted the terrain and exposed more. Flat vegetation relied on photosynthesis, or else trapped protein-rich creatures to survive, and scores of other sorts of flora awaited the infrequent rains to germinate and then grow in a frenzy while the moisture was available. All right, break. So what Gygax is just saying is that we're looking at whole new mutations and variations on old plants. And the other thing, now, he mentions cacti again. Now, he actually mentioned cacti existing over by Ol, when he first crossed the mountains there. And I had thought myself that cacti were only native to the Western Hemisphere. I don't know any other place that they exist. Do they exist in Australia? I'm sure there's no cacti, you know, in Africa, Middle East, Europe, Asia. I really thought cacti were native just to the Western Hemisphere. So we can look at several things. Almost everything in the Flinnes and the Baclunish lands are reflective of European and Asia. Of course, the Middle East areas. Hebmana land is supposedly reflective of Africa. The Olman Islands, though, they are supposed to be reflective of Central America, so the Western Hemisphere. So perhaps we're looking at imported plants that maybe came in during the Sul Imperium, when it was actually looking to expand south, maybe into the Olman areas. It is interesting, a cacti seem appropriate for this this area. Now, when the Rain of Colorless Fire fell, it burns everything, I would assume, all any flesh that can't escape, it burns. Any of the insects burns, avians burn, and all the flora, and including, I would suspect, the topsoil. If it doesn't burn too deep, then the root systems for all the plants are there. And insects may be on the outer edges of the rain, or in areas where they're protected, especially insects, or and birds that have perhaps survived in some of the outposts. Now the ash falls, so it's, I don't know. Now this is the Rain of Colorless Fire, and is, if this fire could burn the water, then it might be able to destroy all like the lakes and the ponds and such. But the interior water sources coming down from the mountains that should feed, and any springs coming up from, underground pressure, they should still exist, but now they're buried beneath the ash. So these plants that he's talking about, they are going to need to either not, there's going to be a whole layer over the main, the whole area there. But the water system should be fine. I mean, other than the water that's stored within the plain, all the water coming down the mountains would still be, should be that, unless they're destroyed by the rising volcanoes. So there should still be streams flowing beneath the surface, and there should still be rain as things are swept in, unless the mountains catch it all, and there's no water to be absorbed in the local areas. But still, there should be some kind of water coming down from the mountains, and perhaps still storms hitting. So this flora, it's not on the surface. It's buried. But its root, and it's not even there unless bits and pieces of it were escaped for, being protected, say, magically. Now, what the ash is, we don't know. It's the byproduct of an immensely powerful magical or clerical event. So what we should be happening, though, is all the volcanoes. We had a terrible eruption out west at Mount St. Helens. And after the eruption, the devastation looked horrifying, and the layers of ash. But what was forgotten by people was that ash, you used to fertilize your land by burning your crop, and the ash would be a fertilizer. And after the Mount St. Helens eruption, there became huge fields of colored flowers and weeds that just crisscrossed the mountainsides. Because with the trees gone, it allowed all the small weeds and brush and stuff whose roots had survived to sprout up and be enriched by all that mineral wealth that is pulled up by volcanic eruptions. Because the soil can get worn out, and it can get wind-blown, and those vital minerals that are coming up from the earth, they can, be used up. But after a volcanic eruption, the material is very rich. It's one of the reasons why Hawaii has such lush vegetation. So it can be a very strange thing. So the hardest thing, that there's going to be areas where the normal ash is coming from the volcanoes. But the ash that came from the colorless fire, that may be of a sort that is even poisonous or deadly or causes mutations. And it's so thick. So, so, you know, it's commented that in the Portland area, they got some of the ash from St. Helens, yes. And I remember, I think it was the Icelandic volcanic eruptions that, you know, brought down, closed all the airports from northern areas for quite a while. So the ash will go up in the atmosphere and it comes down because it's, you know, it's heavier than air. But it's light enough so that it is blown around and it can drift quite a ways. So we have everything denuded to the fire of the colorless fire. And then we have these plants. Now, they've got to grow up through the ash and the compacted ash. But once they do, the water system where the roots are should be fine. Because although that water that wasn't destroyed in the colorless fire, if any of was, I mean, may not even have burned. But there's going to be more water and more water continually coming down from these mountain ranges. So that really, there should be underground rivers and there should be rich areas down there. And plant seed can last for quite a while, even after it's been, in plant roots have been found to survive for quite some time. So, you know, they're very likely, especially over time, to be rich areas and bizarre areas beneath the more sea-like dust that is still above the sea of dust in the Sol Imperium. And if the volcanoes are still active, we're going to get more of the volcanic ash drifting across. But the volcanic ash should not be, unless there's something odd about earthly volcanic ash, or if there's something magical that does it, the volcanic ash should actually help to fertilize the lands in the Sea of Dust. So there can be quite a variety of things found, even upon the surface, and maybe strangely altered, but there could be very lush areas that are still that are found within the Sea of Dust. All right, I'm going to restart. And it is, I've lost my place here, page 132, second paragraph from the end. Rats, mice, and other rodents moved into the waste. Some took to the mazes underneath, while others found conditions on or near the dusty surface favorable. Shrews and moles burrowed there. Badgers came to dwell in the subterranean portion. Foxes and wild dogs roamed the hot black and gray desert above, and with them were snakes and lizards, who likewise hunted their own prey. A few hundred years after the invisible firestorm, the ashen desert was known throughout the continent as a place of death and desolation, a location whose deadly nature was sung of in the Eastern Uruk, related in the Baklunish poems chanted in Jakif, and told in legends elsewhere throughout the Flaness. If there were men alive to contradict this reputation, none of them stepped forward. A few explorers and travelers who related their own experiences simply said that the ashen desert was a void, a place where nothing but the toughest and craggiest of plants could survive. Considering the few areas where animal life could have been seen and the camouflage and protective coloration that was prevalent among the fauna, green that was either so dark as to appear black or so faint as to be gray to the eye, dun-colored skin and hide, black feathers, sooty fur, dusky hair, no casual observer could in truth state otherwise. But of course life did exist in many forms in this strange desert, and if it did not exactly thrive, It was fierce and tenacious, enough to make up for the difficulties it had overcome daily in order to continue. Certain tight-lipped or otherwise uncommunicative sources did know of the true nature of the Ashen Desert. Among them were the nomads who roamed the northern boundary of the place, horsemen and camel-borne men of the barren plains, and the savage folk of the Grand Sul Peaks that walled the steppes from the dust and ash beyond occasionally ventured into the fringes of the place. Explorers from the Sea King's lands managed to cross the Inferno Peaks to seek wealth in the eastern portion of the Ashen Desert, as did certain expeditions sent by the head of the Free State known as the Yeomanry. Possibly folk from other borders of this waste likewise penetrated at least a little way into the Ashen Desert. The legendary peoples of such fabled states as Changol, Jahind and Molwar to the south, and the folk of Sahain, Behau, and Chomar to the west were the sort who would dare such activity. That the waste was a dead and deadly place, however, most would agree. Even those who had entered the Ashen Desert would not disagree that the expanse of powder and ash was hostile, had no possibility of supporting human life, and could never be explored at length beyond its edges. All right, break. There's some comments here too. The fields work in Iceland, especially the lava fields, are very strange and desolate. And part of that, of course, is because they're not being broken down. Especially in Iceland, the more inhospitable domains, it's not breaking down what's the lava. And you'll see that around the active volcanoes in Hawaii, where there's actually one where there's lava, or there was last time I heard about it, where the lava was actually increasing the size of the island because it was coming out and forming this. Now, that more moonscape kind of appearance, especially where there's a hardened lava fields, that material is very, the lava is very rich in minerals. And as it breaks down, goes from the hardened lava and what is that, basalt, it eventually becomes like fertilizes and adds to the mineral richness of the area. So like there's a picture of like the very desolate, I assume this is Iceland, the very desolate areas that are by these lava plains. And Iceland, the areas that are more habitable are the ones near underground geothermal activity, where the area heats up underneath and you actually have energy sources coming from the various activity under the earth. Now, what if this is, if this is, I think that, like, if you see the stuff that's gotten very gray and granular, you're going to have, that is going to be stuff that eventually becomes the material that breaks down into very fine minerals. But there's also a lot of material coming up that is just, is that silicates, that
ash and pumice,
and they are not going to become fertile, but it's the mineral components that actually that come apart and come out. There's a lot of things that in Iceland, I assume a lot of that is becoming because of the wind, actually the winds wearing things down, and maybe the variations between you know, ice and melt. But the thing is, the volcanoes are actually a wonderful resource. And if you think about what we do when we mine, the volcano is actually pulling up all this material for us. It's massively destructive. Yeah, and it's saying that when there's a comet, when there's enough soil, water, the fine ash borne downward on an eruption gives good grass growth a year later on. And of course, the other thing that all this needs is living microbes. And if you have a volcanic eruption that's destroyed all the life in the heated material, it's not going to break down into anything living, fauna, until there's microbiotic life that's gotten into the soil. All right. Well, let me grab the book here, and I just want to mention this because I just think that there's quite a bit, other than the ash, the ancient ash from the original fire. Those volcanoes are eventually going to be fertilizing it, and as time goes by, the sea of dust should turn into a fertile bowl. Maybe one that's inimical to human or humanoid life, but still, I think there's going to, if we looked at the Greyhawk campaign in another, 1,000 years, we might see that, the sea of dust is changing without anything but a normal process going on. And it has been, a millennia since the invoked devastation, so since the reign of colorless fire. All right, I'm sorry. We've got a little left. I want to do a little more here. We've now heard about the fauna with the rats, the mice, the dogs, the moles. We've also been covered. All right, in this section, this is so dense with such good information. All right, so now in the Sulhaut Mountains, or as they call it, the Grand Sulhs, we know that there's dwellers there in Gygaxes. Gygax believes there's mountain dwellers. They also cross over into the Sea of Dust. Now, and in the lands outside, we heard yesterday that those Aradan, who are these nomads around that area, that they are used to running into at least three groups, the Jahind, the Sahan, and the Bahau, who are folks to the west and the south of these legendary people, but they actually are being introduced into this far area in Bakluni lands, but north of the Sul Imperium. So on our maps, we don't see very far south, and we do not see the far west. And in here, Gygax gives us six countries: Changal, Jahind, Malwar, Sahane, Bahau, and Chomor. And if you're going to make a choice, I would say between the war game release, the map that came out in Dragon Annual 1, really, I always put Gygax first. He's the designer of this. I like his work so much that I would much rather see Gygax's interpretations of Gygax's versions of an Indian state or two and of Asian states than what they came out with, which was something of the same, but still some really horrible choice names in Dragon Annual 1 and a really horrific, horrific map for the western side of the continent that looks terrifically like Patrick from SpongeBob. Now, see, I would disagree that the Sea of Dust is dry. I would say that with all those mountain ranges, that maybe the interior is dry, but all the riverbeds would still have been in existence for the flow of water coming down from the mountains surrounding it. And I would just have to think that the Sea of Dust, it's ash-covered, but I don't really think it would be dry. I think there would be this continual flow of what existed. The most of the streams that were coming into the Azul Imperium would mostly still be there, but buried 50, 100 feet deep. Yeah, and Gygax mentions that rivers still flow underneath the ash. Yes, but the ash isn't going to be a glacier. It's the biggest thing that we have to decide upon is what kind of effect the colorless fire burnt out of the Azul Imperium. The volcanic ash is not going to be, you know, it's going to be raw stuff. But it is not going to be poisonous. Well, some will be, but it's not going to be overwhelmingly poisonous or cause mutations like you might get from the ash from the colorless fire.
How viscous do you think it would be? Like, could you walk on it without sinking?
I think that's later addressed in this story. Oh, okay. I believe you can't. I believe it's very fine and powdery. And, if that's like a universal consistent. Now, what they were saying was that the slugs were causing a hardening process, but they could push easily through the ash. And it was their mucal residue that hardened it into tunnels so that the slugs and the puddings and such, they could make their way forward, but it only became hardened tunneling once that mucus stuff had hardened. And then, of course, we're now talking about millennia, you know. So if this colorless fire really did, sift it down to material that was just, it wasn't like normal ash. It was this ash that was, say, either created mutations or created odd life but not normal life, then and that in itself it never would form into anything. It would never harden. Like, say, if you dropped water on it, it wouldn't become like a hardened mud. So it would just, the liquid would just sift down till it actually reached stone or the earth buried beneath the ash. Not a sand, but like little slivers of burnt, something burnt, that it never really ended up being. And so always windborne and ash storms and such, even easier to occur than, say, like sandstorms, because it would be a lighter material. So you would definitely need something to be able to, something like snowshoes, something broad enough to put the pressure from your steps and spread it wide enough out so you're not going to sink into this stuff.
It seems like it's safe for snakes and wild dogs, but I think a person, especially a person carrying a pack or something, would be a little too much.
But you're not sure, because those areas around the edge, and they may be from volcanic activity, because what could happen is we could have areas where there's volcanic ash and the hardened, maybe even hardened lava beneath that surface that goes on top or displaces this colorless fire ash. So, there's a huge amount that, to question about what's going on, with the material of that color, the colorless fire ash. Now, we also have learned there's the sea princes. There, the yeomanry are sending expeditions. Now that we're being talked, they talk here at always about dust and ash. And he refers to the area by the princes, sea princes and yeomanry, as the Inferno Peaks. So you would expect that to be places of great volcanic activity. And also, that's the area, I believe, that was open, maybe hilly or even mountainous, but it wasn't closing off the Sul Imperium. So I believe that's at least one of the areas where these volcanoes rose up and sealed off the lands that would have been the sea prince, that are now sea prince and yeomanry. So I don't think, and of course back then the Sul sorcerers would have no problem. I mean, if you have that Slorotan in an emergency is able to burrow a tunnel from one in an emergency from through the mountains to release, you know, the trapped people and begin the migrations, then you have to realize that he is just, he may have been the greatest mage of power. There are these mages of power that were the great sorcerers and magi of the Sul Imperium. If they needed to do such a project, they could have done it at any time. You know, like they could have leveled those mountains with the power that they're that they seem to have possessed. And so it seems ridiculous to think that the Sul Imperium ever would have been trapped inside that circle of mountains. They could have maybe created them, but I think the circle of mountains is really a result of the Reign of Colorless Fire. And so I don't think if we looked at a map of the Sul Imperium, you would see probably the eastern mountains, the eastern mountain chain, especially down by the Sea Kings, may not have existed at all. So, there's a lot that, I mean, all I've picked up about volcanoes is stuff I've seen on the Nature Channel, and, you know, I'm not an expert or even a, I barely, you know, I don't, just things that have stayed in my mind that may be incorrect. But I do remember them talking about St. Helens and the year after and various things about how people would like to mine if they could, you know, erupt a volcano would be a perfect way of mining. And that island in Hawaii, which was growing. But, and some stuff on Iceland, but maybe completely inconsequential. Is there a map of the Sul Imperium? All right, so this is some map of the Sul Imperium?
Yeah, well, it exists on my computer and it says Sul Imperium. Yeah.
So. All right. I don't really. Oh, maybe it came from the LC, but I don't know if they were allowed to do that.
I'm not sure where I got it.
It's hard to make out. I guess big body of water is actually a sea, and I'm guessing it goes down into the ocean down there, probably.
Yeah. And the crystallists surround it, the Sul Halt are above it.
Yeah, there's mountains within it. I personally don't. It doesn't grab me, but you do. It's great to see.
That's all I have.
That's right. You know, and like I was saying, I read the books first, so I created in my mind's eye what I thought it would look like. And then when I look at another map, I would say, you know, I disagree with this, I disagree with that, because I've already created the image in my mind. So, you need something to work with, grab it, you know, and make whatever changes you want or keep it the same. All right. Well, I've blabbed a lot tonight without much reading. I've only gotten a few pages ahead, but I find this area incredible. It is not a place where there's a lot of sources of information. It's 704, though, so it is page, I've only gotten to page 133 tonight. So I think I've done like five pages. And we're on the last paragraph, but this was just chock full of information, and I just was in a mood to blather, I guess. Until tomorrow night, and I may have to cut things a little short tomorrow. I don't know what time I'm supposed to be on Jay's show, and I don't know what time that is. Might be doing another 7 o'clock. Right, but we will do at least around 45 minutes of the show tomorrow. Yeah, oh, 5094SD. All right, well, until tomorrow night, thanks, everyone. Hope everybody had fun.
It was great, thanks.